Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. We are going to return to Isaiah chapter 7 through 9, kind of clean some things up. Just we're going through a historical progression through the Scriptures, through the Old Testament. And it's just kind of nice to drop in on the prophets once in a while and see how they overlap. Like I said last week, it'd be nice if we could overlap and hear a little bit about what Elijah wrote or what Elisha was writing, besides just hearing the stories about what they did, what were they saying. So we have a chance to do that with Isaiah and Jeremiah. Now, I did ask you to bring your framework books. If you have them, that's great. If not, I've got some back there on the table. We're going to be real close to getting into the time charts that are on or in the framework book. I've also got some Hope for America's Last Generation books right there. And if you notice, those are recycled. Those are the ones I got off of Amazon.com for a penny a piece. And so I'm just buying them back. It's like, you know, and like I said yesterday in church, some of the bindings aren't even broke out. And no one's even opened them up yet. But so I paid for them once. It's cheaper to buy them for a penny on Amazon than it is to print them again. So we'll do that. We bought a bunch of Bibles. I was telling Rick a moment ago. We bought a... there's a guy in Nigeria. I've been sending him stuff, and he wanted some Bibles. He's got several Bible schools, and wanted 48 NIV study Bibles. And so I've just ordered 8 more this afternoon. I got home from school for like 44 cents, 79 cents a copy. NIV study Bibles. I mean, they're what I've got here, except they're paperback, and they're a little bit smaller, but it's the same thing. They're nice Bibles. I would like to buy the English Standard Version Study Bible. I think those are a little bit cleaner, a little bit better, but it's good. I mean, I use the NIV. I like the translation better. It's more accurate. This at different times goes thought for thought when it could have stayed word for word. I mean, if you study the Bible, it doesn't. You know, you're going to get in and study it anyhow. I mean, if you're just reading, then you don't care anyhow. You know, it's close enough. No. And I like the ESV Study Bible footnotes. They're a little more archaeological. They're a little bit newer, more recent. It's a personal preference. I've got a brand new ESV Study Bible right on my shelf right there. I bought it about 5 years ago. And it's like, this is what I want. I looked at this. It's like, that's a two-year process. I just have to shut everything down. It's like, oh, and I can't just bring my ESV and start teaching out of it, because I'd be like, right, yeah. Now when I visit a church, I always take that one so I look like the guy with the new Bible in the back pew. It's like, no one asks me any questions. It's like, I must be the new kid, you know. I found out that we can ship them in these flat rate boxes internationally I can get 7 in a box, and it costs like right around $60. So it's about $9 a Bible to ship. So by the time you spend less than $1 for the Bible, $4 to have it shipped from Amazon, and then $9, it's about $15, $60 to get in their hands. I mean, it's not, usually I bought them for $20 new, then I have to ship them, cost about $10 or $20 to ship them. So I'm real happy with this, don't tell anybody else in Nigeria, otherwise you'll never, but I'm excited that we're going to be able to finish another little project that we had there. But anyway, and then I noticed, I just checked that's why I was buying those. I checked my Hope for America's Last Generation books. So I bought all the ones for a penny or 20 cents. And now it looks pretty good. It's $5 a copy now. So anything that drops below $5, I'd buy it. You know. You ever notice what the price of the Jerusalem book is? Have we ever talked about the price of the Jerusalem book on Amazon.com? This is not a commercial. This is just check it. Well, it's at one time you couldn't get it for less than $400 or $500 a copy, and there may be one out there right now that's selling for $1,900, but no, you're not going to find one for, you can't get one for $20, you can't get one for $50. It's $79. Yeah, they're all autographed, Larry. That's why. I do not know why, but it's just, and I'm sure people aren't paying $400 a time, but no, they're. There's a time where the cheapest one was $300 or $400, and it goes all the way up to a couple thousand, you know, almost $1,900. Yeah, exactly. You know, well, one of the comments on there was, yes, someone did. Yeah, and the thing is, every one of those came out of my garage free, and someone puts it on Amazon for $500. But someone did make a comment on there. This book is available free online And they put the link right there. Click, and there it is. Then if you go look at the pictures on the Generation Word, all they're all colored, you know. So anyway, that's exciting. Okay, I was talking about the framework book. If you look on page 125 of the framework book, this is where we're kind of at. It's kind of sad to think that we've been doing it since 2012, and we've only covered 100 pages in the framework book. But there you see on page 125, you see a list of all the kings of Judah. And I got a little paragraph or so about each one of them, so you could probably go over to page 127, 128, right in the middle of page 128. There we're talking about King Ahaz. That's who we're talking about tonight. That's who Isaiah is addressing in chapters 7 through 9. Then he's going to be followed by Hezekiah. And then by the time Hezekiah is on the throne, we're going to start kind of picking up the timeline that I'm going to show you. Then after Hezekiah, got a lot of information there. There's a picture of the Sennacherib prism. Now, this is a little bit ahead of time, but Hezekiah, of course, is going to be the one who's going to cut Hezekiah's tunnel, taken from the Gihon Springs. We'll talk about it here in just a moment. He's going to cut Hezekiah's tunnel to the other side because the Assyrians are coming down, and they don't want the water just flowing out into the Kidron Valley where they've always had it. Nice, easy flowing river. That's a big deal in these verses. Well, Hezekiah is going to cut that tunnel, and it's going to help save the city. Sennacherib, in his prism that you can see, the little diagram right there, he writes about his invasion of Judah, talks about taking different cities and how he mentions Hezekiah being, well, you can see on the bottom of the page 129. He says, as to Hezekiah the Jew, he did not submit to my yoke. So there Hezekiah is mentioned on that prism. And then he says, himself I made a prisoner in Jerusalem. Indeed he did. They couldn't get out. That's why they cut that tunnel to keep water in the city. His royal residence like a bird in a cage. He said he kept him in his city of Jerusalem like a bird in his cage. And then he just keeps writing. Doesn't talk about having come home defeated. It's like, I had him there, and that's what I did. And so that was he just talks about the highlights. Didn't talk about 185,000 people dying, and he had a retreat. But that's how Hezekiah recorded history. And then you've got the next king, Manasseh, who's going to be the one. Now, I'll tell you this again. But during Ahaz's reign, on page 128, the young king, Isaiah is having children. He's got a child on his hip when he addresses the king in chapter 7. And in chapter 8, it's all about having another child. And so he's a young man, a prophet, I guess, because he's prophesying, but he's having a family. And he's doing daycare while he's on the job. Then he's going to be brought into the royal palace during Hezekiah's time. He's going to be one of the prophets on the royal staff during Hezekiah's reign. Remember, Hezekiah and Isaiah went into the temple. And he's kind of living in the glory days of his prophecy. He's kind of like the man on the scene. Well, when Hezekiah is gone, his son Manasseh becomes king. And now Isaiah is an old man during Manasseh's reign. And he actually is going to be, he's going to kill Isaiah. The story goes in Jewish tradition, and it's referred to, it appears, in the book of Hebrews, that Manasseh was hunting down Isaiah, who had fled and had climbed up in a tree. And they sawed the tree down, and then they sawed Isaiah in half. And that's where you get in Hebrews, some of them were sawed asunder. That's a direct reference back to the Isaiah story in Manasseh's day. So Ahaz, Hezekiah's dad, Isaiah's a young man having children. Hezekiah's reign, Isaiah is a man in the office of the prophet in the royal palace, on staff, because he's, you know, Hezekiah's a godly king. And then in Manasseh's reign, he's an old man, and he's going to be apparently martyred. Again, that slips out of the Bible except for that one reference in Hebrews. Okay, then if you turn to page 132, there I'm walking in Hezekiah's tunnel. That's the tunnel that was cut after these verses in Isaiah 7 through 9, cut in Hezekiah's day. And you can see a diagram of it over there. We'll draw something a little more clear on the board here in a moment. And then go over to page 136. When we get to the year 640, so we're kind of wrapping this up, 745 to 640 B.C. When we get to 640, now you've got Josiah on the throne, and now we're going to begin the days of Jeremiah and Josiah. And this is kind of why I want you to have this, because then these will be kind of like the notes right here. This is just a year-by-year. And I've got over in the summary column on the right side, I've got the king. I've got the name of the prophecy. For example, in 640, Josiah is the king. Jeremiah is a prophet. Zephaniah is a prophet. And Habakkuk's a prophet. So that is the year 640. We know of three prophets who were writing, and we've got their text in Scripture, and they're all talking about the Babylonians are coming. And Josiah's on the throne, and he knows because he just found the law of the Lord in the tabernacle, or temple, after the days of Manasseh. And we'll get into all that. It kind of gives you all the, you can see different dates over there or events there. Yes, sir. Yep. They picked their way through it. And they started at both ends, and they met in the middle. There's like two or three different theories on how the engineering was done. And it's got a very gradual decline, so the water flows from the Gihon Springs. It's not like rushing downhill, because they've got to go, it's 3 football fields long, and it's just down just long enough, or just enough grade, that it just flows. Well, we walked through it a couple of times. And it just flows, it's always steady flowing and fills up the Pool of Siloam. It was an engineering feat. They started on this end, and they tunneled right underneath Jerusalem, and they met in the middle. And where they met, you can see where they met, because the pick marks, you know, as they're chipping away, the pick marks are going one side, you know, and they meet. And then they cut a plaque. And it was when they found it in the 1800s, I can't tell you the exact year, they found it in the 1800s, there's a plaque on the wall, a Hebrew inscription on the wall from the days of right around 700 B.C. The inscription matches the days of Hezekiah, and it talks about the workmen could hear each other talking as they neared together, and then they finally broke through. This is the Hebrew inscription. You can look it up online. We could hear the workmen could hear each other talking, and then finally their picks broke through and the water flowed. So one side had water, they're working in water, the other side was working dry, their picks broke through and it matched perfectly. I mean, some would say one but maybe the best answer is how they did it was there may have been a crack, because as you walk through it, it's not even a straight shot. It's like you're weaving around. Sometimes the ceiling is high, sometimes the ceiling is low. There's just a couple places where they've started, and they backed up, and they went another direction. I mean, not like a long ways, but you can see they started. One idea is that there was a crack, just a natural crack through the whole bedrock, and water seeped through, just naturally seeped through. They knew that water was seeping through, and they just followed that crack in the rock. Others say, another idea that I think... I've studied this, but I haven't studied in the last 2 or 3 years. But they took a tapper on the top, and they tapped, and they followed the sound of the tapping. And so they had a line drawn up on top, and they would tap. And why they weaved, it's like, well, they had to go around buildings, you know. They got off track because it's like, no, he's tapping over here. They had to come back. I mean, that's one idea, another idea. But it's amazing because it's not like just this... It's a very gradual in the water. It still works today. Right. There's Canaanite, the Canaanite tunnel. That's what's going to be referred to here in Isaiah chapter 7 through 9. The gently flowing waters of Shiloh. And we saw that right before we stepped down into the Hezekiah's tunnel. You go by a tunnel and have a little arrow, the Canaanite tunnel, and a lot of times they missed it. But I went in there and got a couple pictures, and now that's real obvious how they did it. They cut it from the top down. You can see it's. I'm doing that because I'm walking Hezekiah, I'm looking back. But it's cut down like this from the top. They just scooped it out like this down, and then they threw rocks in, big rocks. And they fell down, and then they ledge in there. So you can still see. You can look. I haven't posted my pictures from 2012. I just haven't taken time to do a good job of it. But you can find other people's pictures. If you take a picture of it, you can see the wedged wall, and then the big rocks that they dropped in. They couldn't come all the way down, so they created a man-made tunnel. Does that make sense, what I just said? The Canaanite, that was there probably when David took the city. It's an old Canaanite tunnel, because you've got this natural water source. You've got this natural water. Okay, let me see if I can do this. Here's the Kidron Valley. Here's the Mount of Olives. I've got two maps going here. I'm going to just erase this. here's the mount, here's the ridge of old Jerusalem. The city of David sits on this part of the ridge. It continues to rise, and this is Mount Moriah. This was where Abraham offered Isaac. This was the threshing floor of the Jebusites. It became the temple of Solomon. Today it's the Temple Mount, where today they're rioting up there and throwing stones and chanting death to America or whatever. But our Secretary of State says about the Iranian, you saw it, the Iranian, what do you call it, deal, the treaty. Is there going to be an Iranian treaty? And his response was, did you hear that? If it be Allah's will. Our Secretary of State, look it up. That's what he said. The reporter says, will there be a deal? He says, if it's Allah's will. And he said it in Arabic. Okay, hey, it's your country. Anyway. Yeah, is that not amazing? Maybe it's just good diplomatic skills to make that bridge. He's building a bridge this direction, but he's burning bridges on the other side. It's like, I don't know. Okay, yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry I went off on that. Seriously, why did I even go there? I know I wanted to. Okay, this is the Kidron Valley here. And right here is the Gihon Springs. It's a water source. It's a natural water source that as it rains during the seasons, it drains underground and it pools up here. And there's always a pressure of water here. And it's Gihon means gush. And as it pressurizes, it just all of a sudden it just gushes out and water just pushes out. And you ever heard of Solomon's Gardens or the King's Gardens? Or when Abraham met the king of Sodom, remember that Abraham meets him with Melchizedek? They met right down here in this valley. And the water, they would have tunnels of water or channels of water. Sometimes they'd open, they can still see someplace where there's stones would cover them. So there'd be like little channels that they'd cover with stones and water would flow. It was just watering the king's gardens down here. So this would be Solomon's Gardens down where Silwan is today. The Palestinian city down here is today. And some of us, we walked through that. You want to go in as a group. But anyway, that was where it was. But the water was outside the city. And that's what Hezekiah is going to be concerned about, is this water, this natural water. People could go down there, Jebusite, they drop the water from the top. They could go down a certain stairway and drop the bucket down and get water out of the Gihon Springs and go up. That's how Joab got into the city, through these Gihon Springs right here. So everybody knew about it. Even David said, if you're going to take the city, you're going to have to go up through the springs. Well, what Hezekiah does is he's got to get water over to this side of the city where it's inside the wall. So he cuts the channel this way and runs the Gihon Springs this way, and they stop using for at least temporarily, stop letting water come out there, because if the Assyrians would have come and surrounded the city in a siege, all the water of the Gihon Springs would just water their horses and all the men. And Israel wouldn't have any water, but the Assyrians would. You can read that in the text. Hezekiah says, why should the king of Assyria find water when he comes here? We're going to tunnel through here and keep it in. And they built the Pool of Siloam, which has been discovered. And it's right here. And that was in the New Testament. And the water flows over there. Does that help you out at all? Okay. It's not as, again, I want to say it's not as hard as you think it is, because they're cutting limestone. See, Solomon's, it's the same stone that Solomon's temple stones were built out of. So they're using the picks. They're using, you can see pick marks. They're skilled craftsmen. The picking is not an impossible thing, because you're not picking granite. You know, you're picking through a limestone, a very nice quality limestone. That's all throughout the city. And there's different quarries that have been found. We can push that concept of the core of this conversation if we wanted to, because even Golgotha, where Jesus, if you accept the concept of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, is the place of the crucifixion and the resurrection, they quarried out all the good limestone. And this is seen even yet today. I mean, archaeology can go there and ask whatever it's been built on. But nonetheless, they take it out. And in Jesus' day, it was an abandoned quarry. All the good stone had been removed. And that's why Joseph of Arimathea, who was wealthy, had bought a plot of ground there and was cutting out of the abandoned quarry a tomb so he could have, you know, for his burial place. It was, if it had been good stone, they would have excavated it and used it for building, but it's like, it's no longer any good. And so even that, where the Church of Holy Sepulchre is, that was a quarry. So they would cut out the good stones underneath the Temple Mountain. We went down into there. You can see, you still see stone pick marks, but also just piles of stone as they took out the best stone and just exhausted the quarries and built Solomon's Temple and built these things. So this is possible to pick through. I don't know that much about it. I mean, I've never picked a tunnel or built an axe out of metal. The amazing thing still for me is, and I think many other people, and it's worth researching, is how they met, because they met in the middle. I mean, they didn't have walkie-talkies, radio, cell phones. I mean, they meet in the middle. Somehow there's something directed, maybe a crack in their stone. And then when they get done, they pick through it and the water flowed. So they just it's easy to think how they just kept picking this way because it just kept going, just the water kept flowing. But then they meet halfway through, and they're still perfect, and it just flows right on down into the pool. I mean, there's some things going on here. I mean, and we're not talking about space aliens or miracles or, you know, life from another planet. We're just talking about some kind of engineering feat that you can go aliens if you want to. The Nephilim did it. I mean, that's kind of exciting too, but I don't think we need to do that. Okay. Anyway, here's what we've got here tonight, and I do appreciate the questions. I guess what I just took you up to, what I've shown you, is kind of where we're going to take you in framework, and that why you're going to want, because we can use that chart that picks up in 740 B.C. with Josiah, Jeremiah, Zephaniah, Habakkuk, and the coming Babylonians. But remember, tonight the problem is not the Babylonians, the problem is the Assyrians. And so down here, I have this drawn on here, you've got Galilee, the Jordan River, the Dead Sea. And down here, the king is Ahaz. This is the king of Judah, Hezekiah's dad. Up north, we've got Pekah. And up here in Syria or Aram, you've got Rezin is the king. And so Pekah, Tiglath-Pileser is putting pressure on. And Pekah and Rezin are going to unite, and they have united. We go all the way through the days of Elijah and Elisha, King Ahab and his family, Jehu and his great grandson Jeroboam. The Arameans or the Syrians were always fighting with Israel, the northern kingdom. Now they've united. Remember, they would come down here and fight at Ramoth-Gilead for the trade routes. Now Tiglath-Pileser and the Assyrians are pushing in here, wanting to come down here and establish a trade route through the Megiddo Valley with the coastal plain to trade with Egypt. They just want to bypass all of this. And Pekah and Rezin, the Syrians and Israel, have decided to take over Ahaz, take over Judah, and put it in there. It's nothing different than what goes on in the Middle East today of trying to power. So these two are uniting because they need to, because Tiglath-Pileser is coming. Okay? So that's where we left off last week. Ahaz is the king, and he's heard that these people are trying to replace him. So he's out checking some water, probably up on the north side. It's probably called Hezekiah's Pool today. I'll push this. Has anybody watched the video I put up with the Bob Dylan song, Things Have Changed? I put it on my Facebook page. It's a little video of me walking around. Anybody watch that video? It's on my Facebook page. I just reposted it. Okay. Anyway, Bob Dylan. It's a great song by Bob Dylan, and I know he's not in the Bible. But anyway, he's singing there. But I'm up on top of, I went up into the Petra Hotel, which is an old rickety hotel from the 1800s. Mark Twain, when he went there and did his first Innocents Abroad, legend has it that he stayed there, and that's still in part of the discussion. But anyway, when I get up there, I film straight to the east, and I can film the Temple Mount, I can film the Dome of the Rock. I bring my camera and I go this way and film the Church of the Holy Sepulchre over here, the cross and the resurrection symbol over here. And as you look out and I look down, there's this big empty pool, not swimming pool, but you can just tell it's a big empty That's Hezekiah's field. That's Washerman's field. That's Washerman. That's probably where Ahaz is at here in Isaiah chapter 7. It's probably, there's water right up there. Okay? Anyway, here we go. Yep. Yep. But they started cleaning it up. Since we were there, they started cleaning it up. And so, yeah, it was, first time I went there, it was just, it was wet and there was water. It just looked like sewage. People were throwing garbage. It was like a landfill. And they started cleaning it up. And so, okay, we are in Isaiah chapter 7. I'm going to read a few things I read last week as we begin here. And the clock is ticking. Remember, chapter 6 of Isaiah, King Uzziah dies. He's the king that got leprosy for going into the temple. And his son Ahaz is now the king. So Isaiah is commissioned into as a prophet in the year Uzziah died, which is 740. Okay? And then we read all that. He sees it and he's called to be a temple. And he's given this message in verse 9. He's going to go tell this people, be ever hearing but never understanding. It's like, oh, what a loser mission. And so anyway, that's what he's called to do. He's going to go speak this word. And one thing I want to point out, I pointed this out in church yesterday. Isaiah's ministry is going to approach this and really get a handle on this. You've got to take the Christmas story, because we know all these verses up in the Bible about the Christmas story. You know, we pick this verse out. We think Isaiah is talking about Jesus all the time. Jesus is in the distant future in Isaiah's day. Isaiah is preaching a message of disaster. He's just been told, go to a people that will not listen, and I'm going to destroy them. And then when there's a tenth of the people left, he says, I will destroy them. Well, you can see that in chapter 6, verse 12. Until the Lord has sent everyone far away and the land is utterly forsaken. That's the end of Isaiah's ministry. And though a tenth remains in the land, it will again be laid waste. God said, I'm going to destroy it until everybody's gone. But if for some reason a tenth of them crawl up out of the holes as a tenth of them, I'll bring someone in and crush them again. I'm going to destroy the land. But as the terebinth and the oak leave stumps when they are cut down, so the holy seed will be the stump in the land. So you've got to really, again, to read this right, to read this healthy. Isaiah is reading, is speaking to a people that is going to be wiped out. There is no hope for Israel. And when Jeremiah gets ready, there's no hope for Judah. They are going into captivity. But throughout Isaiah, there's always, just like at last there, but the stump will remain. And it's going to come back. So there is hope in Isaiah, but it's a hope for a distant hope. The hope, the virgin will be with child. And we're going to read that in chapter 7. I had some questions after class last week. It's like, well, what about, wasn't that talking about Jesus? Again, understand how I'm going to say this. This book is not about Jesus. This book is about Isaiah, a prophet, speaking to his people, speaking to his king, saying, you're in so much trouble if you don't play this political game correctly. If you don't stand in your faith, you won't stand at all. Yes, but what about Jesus? Well, within Isaiah, all of his prophecies of destruction is always going to be that hope, that promise. But it's in the distance. It's 700 years away. It's when Jesus comes. There's no hope for Ahaz. There's no hope for Israel. But as far as God's plan, he's going to crush these people in his plan, but his plan will surface again. Oh, yeah, it's a message of hope. And that's what we always run back and find those verses of hope and tell the Christmas story. But we're reading this. We're not reading this as part of the gospel presentation. We're reading this tonight as part of the historical progress. I'm not denying Isaiah 53 is about Jesus. You know, I'm not denying that the virgin birth is mentioned here. But that's not what Isaiah was writing about, speaking at his time. He would say, oh, just everything's going to be fine. I'm going to talk about Jesus. He's saying, it's not going to end well, but there's going to be hope. God's plan will prosper, but not in your life, not in your country. So he's talking in two directions. So anyway, keep that in mind. Here we go. Chapter 7, I read this last week. When Ahaz, son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, was king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram, that's the king up here in Syria, and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, marched up to fight against Jerusalem, but they could not overpower it. So Ahaz is being attacked right now by these two kings. The Syrians, the Arameans, and the Israelites have united. They're bitter enemies over the last two centuries, but they've united against Judah because they want this territory for their little new coalition. Okay? Now, the house of David, now this is kind of important. I'm getting too far into this. But up on the top there, it says, Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel. Pekah, son of Remaliah. Remaliah is nobody. In fact, Isaiah is going to stop calling him Pekah. He's going to just call him son of Remaliah. That's son of Remaliah, meaning the son of who? I mean, no one's even heard of him. He's nobody. Pekah just took over. He's some guy came up and just took over. He's got no covenant. He's got no promise. He's going nowhere. Once we kill him, his dynasty's over. He's the son of Remaliah. That is to be contrasted, I believe, with this right here. Now the house of David was told. Not Ahaz, but Ahaz is of the house of David. He comes from the line of David, who's not just a great man, but has got some great promises that he'll have a son sitting on the throne forever. The Messiah is in this line. So now the word, the house of David is told, the man sitting on the throne of the house of David is told, there's a nobody up here threatening you. So what are you going to do about it? Well, he goes into a panic. And the point is, you shouldn't be in a panic. This is the son of nobody. You're sitting on the throne of David. You have a covenant with the Lord God Almighty. So did you have a question for the prophet? I don't want to listen to the prophet. I'm worried politically about what's going on. And that's kind of the breakdown right here. He doesn't realize all the advantages, the tools, the spiritual tools that he's got. Here we go. Now the house of David was told Aram has allied itself with Ephraim. That's northern Israel. So the hearts of Ahaz and his people were shaken as the trees of the forest are shaken in the wind. Now that's irony. That's kind of pointing. It's like the house of David is shaken by this. That's whole Isaiah's entire message is this is not even worth mentioning, except the fact that you're going to destroy your relationship with God because you're overreacting to something that's not even an issue. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out, you and your son, Shear Jashub. This is important to understand. Isaiah is taking one of his sons with him, and he's an infant. He's a child. Go out, you and your son, to meet Ahaz at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the washerman's field. Now, that's why I was talking about that Hezekiah's pool. That might be the general area where now we're on the north part of the city up by the Joppa Gate where there's another water source where they'll have aqueduct bringing water in. So he's up there checking the northern because the invasion always comes from the north because you can't invite, you know, up the Kidron Valley and the Hinnom Valley. They're going to invade in this part where the water source is at. Say to him, go up there while he's checking out his water sources. You take one of your children with you and you say to him, be careful, keep calm, and don't be afraid. And so he comes up. Now again, Isaiah may have been somehow connected to the line of Judah. He's going to get into the palace. He's going to get in the throne as a prophet with Hezekiah. So he's not really a nobody. Jeremiah is going to be of the priestly line. He comes from the city of Anathoth. So Jeremiah is a priest. Got in trouble with all the priests. They wouldn't let him in the temple. Isaiah maybe is connected like with Daniel is in the royal family. Isaiah may be in the royal family. Not in line for the throne, but he may be a cousin of the uncle who's, you know, third in line or something. But he may have some royal blood in him. But he says to the king, that's how he had access to him. Be careful, keep calm, and don't be afraid. Do not lose heart because of these two smoldering stubs of firewood. Who are the two smoldering stubs of firewood? There's nobody up here in Syria, and there's nobody who's on the throne of Israel. Because of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and of the son of Remaliah. Now he drops the name Pekah. Now he's just the son of Remaliah. They're nobodies. Aram, Ephraim, and Remaliah's son have plotted your ruin, saying, let us invade Judah. Let us tear it apart and divide it among ourselves and make the son of Tabeel king over it. In other words, I can tell you more. These guys, I can tell you who they got planned to take your place. They've got someone in the wings who are going to sit on your throne. And he says, yet this is what the sovereign Lord says. This is what man says, but I'm here to tell you this. It will not take place. It's not going to happen. That's not even an issue. Stop looking over the wall. They're not even going to. They can't bother you. God will not let it happen. For the head of Aram is Damascus, meaning the country is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is only Rezin, meaning the head of this country is Damascus of Syria, and the head of that is Rezin. It's a man. It's a nobody. So they're only as strong as who they are. There's nothing there to worry about. And he says, within 65 years, Ephraim will be too shattered to be a people. And indeed, it's not going to be Syria that overruns Israel or Ephraim here. It's going to be Tiglath. And again, one of the reasons they're calling Israel this time Ephraim is because they're being crushed in. They're in the hill country of Ephraim. The borders are collapsing. Okay, that's why they're siding with Rezin. They're collapsing. So now they're basically, northern Israel is basically just in the hill country of Ephraim. So they're calling them Ephraim. It's like the United States just keeps collapsing and collapsing. The only thing that's left is, you know, what's Iowa going to do in the world affair? It's like, you know, nothing's left but Iowa and Minnesota. You know, that's kind of the issue there. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is only Remaliah's son. Once again, it doesn't say his name. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. This is not a problem. But if you consider it a problem and act like it's your problem, you're going to fail. But if you'll stand firm in your faith and let me take care of the house of David, this is not a problem. If you don't stand firm in your faith, you won't stand at all. Again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz. And this is where we started getting slippery last week. So again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz, or else through Isaiah. So Ahaz, the king, is listening to Isaiah. And then the Lord raises up in Isaiah's heart again and says, ask the Lord your God for a sign, more than the deepest depths or the highest heights. In other words, this is the word. Now ask something and God will do it. Ask for something and he'll make it happen to confirm this word that you've got nothing to worry about, Ahaz. Look at this. Look at Ahaz's response. But Ahaz says, I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test. I'm not going to mess with your God. Then Isaiah says, hear now, you house of David. Again, talking to Ahaz. But now, the house of David that's got the covenant, the eternal covenant. Listen, you house of David with the eternal covenant. He says, is it not enough to try the patience of men? You're not just messing with me, Isaiah. Will you try the patience of my God also? Listen, you can mock me, but this is God talking. And you're crossing a line here, and you're challenging God. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. And this sign right here, now you understand. Historically, you understand exactly where we're at historically. Now here's the sign. And it just slips through your fingers. You've got to deal with it. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. There's going to be, the word virgin is a big discussion. And again, it means an unmarried woman who doesn't have children. So she's a virgin. Will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. And that's important. This is Emmanuel, which means God with us. It's not the name of the son that he brought with him, Shir Jashub. This is Emmanuel. This is your sign. Since you won't ask for one, here it is. There's going to be a virgin who's going to send the Messiah. But now, be careful, because in chapter 8, we're going to have another son born to Isaiah. And you've got to decide how you're going to go through these verses. Isaiah is going to start talking about now, I think, real quickly, he's going to start talking about his son in context. We just shot a prophecy about Jesus in the distant future. Now, you've got to decide as we read these, are we going to go there and stay now? Or is that just, okay, you're done. You put the Lord to the test. Here's your sign. It's going to happen in 700 years. There's nothing. Here's your sign. Nothing. You can see. Boom. He shoots it 700 years in the future, and then he comes back. You understand what I'm saying? Meaning, there's no deliverance for you. But there will be a virgin who'll have a son. We'll call him God with us. That could have been yours. Not that Jesus would have been born at that time, but God could have been with you. We're going to shove that in the distant future. Now, he says he, talking about a child. Now, we come back to 700 B.C. The year would be 733. And it's important to understand this is 733 B.C. I'll show you on the charts. He will eat curds and honey when he knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right. But before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste. You understand? There's going to be a boy, a baby's going to be born, but before he knows, and he's going to eat curds, what he's going to be eating is curds and honey, meaning it's going to be produced milk, it's going to be honey that's raised. The boy is going to grow up eating good food from a prosperous time. He's going to eat the best of the land, this boy that's going to be born. Now, so he's talking, I think, about his son that's going to be born yet. But before the boy knows enough to reject wrong and choose right, do you understand what I'm saying? This baby that's going to be born, he shoots a prophecy about Jesus, but that's the sign. Now he comes back, he's going to give him another sign. There's going to be another baby born. And this boy is going to grow up drinking good milk, eating honey, I mean, going through drive-thrus, ordering pizza. It's going to be a great culture. There's going to be deliverance for you, Ahaz. This baby's going to be born, and there'll be deliverance for you. He's not going to grow up, you know, eating, you know, dirt, starving under a siege. He's going to grow up going through drive-thrus. It's going to be a nice world for this kid. But before he knows enough to reject wrong and choose right, before he's 2, 3, 4 years old, the land of the two kings you dread, these two kings right here, before the baby that's going to be born, before he can tell you what's right and what's wrong, these two kings, he says, the land of those two kings you dread will be laid waste. He said, we're going to have a child now. And by the time he's born and grows, before he can say yes or no, right or wrong, your problem's going to be gone, Ahaz. Just stand here and stand with me. God's going to take care of this. The Lord will bring on you and your people and on the house of your father a time unlike any since Ephraim broke away from Judah. He will bring the king of Assyria. That's Tiglath-Pileser. In that day, the Lord will whistle for flies from the distant streams of Egypt and for bees from the land of Assyria. They will all come and settle in the steep ravines and crevices in the rocks and on the thorn bushes and at all the water holes. In that day, the Lord will use a razor hired from beyond the river, the Euphrates, that's the Assyrians, the king of Assyria, to shave your head and the hair of your legs and to take off your beards also. In that day, a man will keep alive a young cow and two goats, and because of the abundance of milk they give, he will have curds to eat. All who remain in the land will eat curds and honey. In that day, in every place where there were 1,000 vines worth 1,000 silver shekels, there will only be briars and thorns. Men will go there and bow with bow and arrow, for the land will be covered with briars and thorns. For as for all the hills once cultivated by the hoe, you'll no longer go there for fear of the briars and thorns. They'll become places where the cattle are turned loose and where sheep run. Now, in other words, this is what's going to take place. Real quickly, what I just said. This king, these guys right here that you're fearing, they're not going to be a problem. Because there's going to be a razor come from abide beyond the river, the Euphrates. He's going to come. He's going to take the Arameans. He's going to take Israel. And this land that they used to harvest, remember, this is where the good vineyards was, that Ahab tried to get the good vineyards. You won't even go there. It's going to be a deserted land. It's going to be a land of ruin. It's going to be overrun. Down here, you'll have prosperity because God is going to continue to take care of Judah. But up here, the land will be laid waste. Now remember, this is going to be a land of darkness. This is the land, the northern Israel. That's going to come up in Isaiah's prophecy. And it's going to play in the Easter or the Christmas story. Chapter 8. Continuing right along, same year, 733. The Lord said to me, take a large scroll and write on it with an ordinary pen, Maher Shalel Hashbaz. And I will call in Uriah the priest and Zechariah, son of Zerubbabel, as reliable witnesses for me. Uriah the priest is the high priest. So understand, Isaiah's got some kind of context there, even as a young man. He's going to have the high priest. He's going to take and write this name on a scroll. And then the guys are going to come in, and they're going to watch him write the name. Then they're going to sign at the bottom. The high priest and another witness are going to sign at the bottom. It's going to be rolled up and sealed, probably dated. Why? Because that's the name of the son that's going to be born to Isaiah. You see, we're talking about two babies. We're talking about Emmanuel. That's the sign. You'll never see it. But here's the sign. Because you don't want that sign. You don't want Emmanuel. Here's your sign. Your sign is going to be Maher Shalel Hashbaz. And I will call in Uriah the priest and Zechariah, son of Jeberechiah, as reliable witnesses for me. What, now, are you with me? Are you understanding this at all? Yes? I mean, okay. I might be going too slow. I felt like I got some people confused last week. Verse 3. Then I went to the prophetess, and she conceived and gave birth to a son. Do I need to explain that? Isaiah, the prophet, goes to his wife, who she calls the prophetess. Now you can have a debate. Is she also a prophet with the spiritual gift of prophesying, or is she simply the wife of the prophet who is called the prophetess? That's really not a discussion, right? You know what I'm saying? That's really not the issue. The point that is here is she is his wife, and she goes in, and they're not prophesying to each other, okay? She's conceiving, and in 9 months, she's going to give birth to a son. And the Lord said to me, name him Maher Shalel Hashbaz. And what does that mean? You probably got your footnotes. It means quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil. In other words, here's the son. Because you didn't want Emmanuel, here's the son. What's his name mean? Quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil. What are you talking about? Just like I told you, before this child can say yes or no, right or wrong, these kings will be over. This place is going to be overrun by the Assyrians. It's going to be swift. It's going to be quick. Watch him. Before he's out of diapers, this problem is going to be gone. So now Isaiah's carrying on this baby. What's your baby's name? Quick to the plunder, quick to the spoil. What's that mean? It's like Ahaz is freaking out about something that he could have just trusted God. He could have had Emmanuel, but instead he got this. So he names that before the boy knows how to say my father or my mother, the wealth of Damascus, that's the capital of Assyria up here. Before the boy knows how to say this, the wealth of Damascus and the plunder of Samaria, the capital of Israel, will be carried off by the king of Assyria. The Damascus and Syria, the wealth will go up north to Tiglath-Pileser. Meaning you didn't have to worry about these two guys because the Tiglath-Pileser is going to take care of it. The Lord spoke to me again. Because this people, are you still with me? Ahaz is going, we're going to go back if I hurry, and I'm not going to get it done because I'm not doing it. This whole time, what's going on, and you read 2 Kings and you read 2 Chronicles, Ahaz, instead of listening to Isaiah, is taking treasure and sending it to Tiglath-Pileser and saying, would you help me? Isaiah says, don't do that. Don't make a treaty with Tiglath-Pileser. God's going to use him, but he's going to use him to defend you. You don't need to pay for it. And then he's going to send Uriah. In fact, Ahaz is going to go up and meet with him. We're going to read that here in 2 Chronicles. And come down. And this very priest you just read about right here, Uriah the priest who got the name, he's going to come down and Ahaz is going to bring him the plans for the Assyrian altar. So this is a cool altar. This is why they're so strong. This is their God. And they're going to go onto the Temple Mount. All the priests are going to scoot the temple of the altar of the Lord out of the way, over to the side. And they're going to build an Assyrian altar in front of the temple of God. It's kind of like, that's why Isaiah is like, what are you doing? It's all taken care of. So he goes up, and that's all coming up. So, I mean, that's what's going on during this prophecy. Yes, ma'am. Iraq, Iran, yep. I mean, it's, yes. Yeah, I mean, the coral, yeah. Yeah. Feel free. Now here, chapter 8, verse 5. Now, this is where we talked earlier about, it seems like we were wandering to talk about the Hezekiah's tunnel in the water, okay, but watch this. The Lord spoke to me again, because this people has rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloh and rejoices over Rezin, this is who they're concerned about, and the son of Remaliah, because they would, in other words, remember, the gently flowing water, Hezekiah's tunnel has not been built yet because Ahaz is his father. There's no need for Hezekiah's tunnel yet. They've still got the Gihon Springs gushing out water that's flowing down into the bottom of the Kidron Valley where Silwan's at today, watering the... It's a beautiful land. It's not a desolate land, the area down there in the Kidron Valley. The water just gushes out and it just flows. It's designed just to flow. Just enjoy it. But because you've rejected this and you're more concerned about these two guys... Therefore, the Lord is about to bring against them the mighty floodwaters of the river. Because you've rejected this gentle flowing waters of Shiloh, God is going to bring the waters, the floods of the river down. The king of Assyria, with all his pomp, it will overflow all its channels. In other words, here's the thing. I mean, you can just see it developing. Ahaz takes gold, sends it to Tiglath-Pileser, invade these people. Okay, good idea. You could have had Shiloh, just the gently flowing waters, but instead, you got him moving, and when you can't control Tiglath-Pileser. When he comes down and takes Aram or Syria, he's going to march right onto Israel, taking Israel, and the water's going to overflow its bank that you had intended politically. Your treaty's not going to stand. It's just going to keep right on coming. Now you are going to face Tiglath-Pileser. But I had a treaty with him. I gave him money to come down and help me. Yeah. It's you rejected the gentle flowing waters and you unleashed the floodwaters of the Tigris or the Euphrates. It's coming this way, here, and right down into Judah. And his son's going to have to deal with it. What's his son going to do? He's going to dig a tunnel through Jerusalem underneath to save that water and keep it inside the city because he says, I don't want them to find that water. Okay, it's just interesting how that water's all kind of playing into this. In verse 8, and sweep on into Judah, swirling over it, passing through it, and reaching up to the neck. Its outspread wings will cover the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. Raise the war cry, you nations, and be shattered. Listen, all you distant lands, prepare for battle and be shattered. Prepare for battle, be shattered. Devise your strategy, but it will be thwarted. Propose your plan, but it will not stand. For God is with us. In other words, you can make your strategy okay. I'll read just a little more. The Lord spoke to me, to Isaiah, with a strong hand upon me, warning me not to follow the way of this people. Because Isaiah is a man, and he's watching all this political activity, watching all this religious activity, and the Lord came on him on a strong hand on him and says this. He says, not to follow the people. He said it this way, talking to Isaiah, you do not call conspiracy everything that these people call conspiracy. Do not fear what they fear, and do not dread it. In other words, don't follow their philosophy. Don't follow their political plans because they're twisted. I will tell you what to fear. I will tell you what is a conspiracy. And don't take advice from this group. They're done. The Lord Almighty is the one you are to regard as holy. He is the one you are to fear. He is the one you are to dread. And that is in contrast to who else would Isaiah be fearing? Well, like Ahaz, he's fearing the political powers. He's fearing, you know, the religious powers. It's like, don't go there. And he will be a sanctuary, but for both the house of Israel, he will be a stone that causes men to stumble and a rock that, now you heard that verse before, and a rock that makes them fall. God says, don't go over there. Otherwise, if you get in that group, the very source of your deliverance, the very Emmanuel, will become a stumbling stone to you too, because they've rejected me. They don't recognize me. They just stumble over me. You don't listen to them. You stay here because I'm going to go to them and they'll reject and they'll just, all they can do is trip on me. Now that applies to Jesus in 30 AD, but it's happening right here in 740 BC. We could go on and on. Oh, I want to read this. I mean, there's so many things to just jump out now. Oh, I got to read this, please. Verse 18. See if this makes sense. Here am I, Isaiah, and the children the Lord has given me. Okay? We are signs and symbols in Israel from the Lord Almighty. In other words, his children have names that are prophetic names. Isaiah is not going to go the way. He's going to stand here and wait for God. And they're over making political treaties, conspiring, compromising. He says, me and my family, we're a sign. And in context, he's talking about him and his sons. When verse 19, when men tell you to consult mediums and spiritists who whisper and mutter, should not a people inquire of their God? In other words, you're trying to find some kind of spiritual connection. You're trying to go in deep into the spiritual realm and find some spiritual connection. Shouldn't you just consult with your God? That's what we're trying to find, God. We're trying to get connection with God. It's like, no. He says, why consult the dead on behalf of the living to the law and to the testimony? In other words, you don't need to go find your God. He says, go to the law of Moses. Go to the testimony of the prophets that have been written. Well, they're over here. They're having all these. Remember, they've got the high places that are still dedicated to Yahweh. But doing all these pagan rituals and muttering and uttering and trying to find some kind of spiritual connection. He goes, no. Go to the law and the testimony. To the law and to the testimony. If they do not speak according to the word, they have no light of dawn. In other words, if they do not speak, they're uttering and muttering. If it doesn't line up with this, they've got nothing to tell you. There's nothing new to find. Distressed and hungry, they'll roam. Now I got to move on. Verse 9, chapter 9. I just wanted to read this because now remember, I told you this land has been overrun. This is the land of Galilee. Nevertheless, no matter how... Now here's one of those places where he throws out that promise. This land is going to be overrun. No hope. Where they used to have vineyards and hoes, as far as cutting the vineyards and stuff, nothing. You don't even want to go up there. Nevertheless, here's the promise. There will be no more gloom for those who were in distress. In the past, meaning in this day, with what's taken place, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. You know what that is? That's this northern land up here north of Galilee. It's on this border. How did he humble it? With the invasion of the Assyrians. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, but in the future, he will honor Galilee of the Gentiles. Because once this happens, this land, once Assyria comes in, it's never Judah's again, it becomes a land of Gentiles. Eventually, the Romans even occupy it. He says, but he will once again, in the future, honor Galilee of the Gentiles by the way of the sea along the Jordan. the people walking in darkness, what darkness? This Gentile darkness from being overrun by the Assyrians. These people have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation, increased their joy. In other words, what's he talking about? That's always a verse that refers to who? Jesus coming out of Galilee. The land has done. The New Testament writers say that what he's saying, they're going to be humbled. Okay, just to keep this in context, I'm sorry, that took way longer than I intended. Go back to 2 Kings, please. 2 Kings chapter 16. And I want to, if I can, I've got about 5 minutes left. This is King Ahaz. This is the king we were just talking about. You saw him interacting with the prophet Isaiah. And remember, the prophet Isaiah is going to interact with Ahaz. He's going to interact with Hezekiah. And he's going to interact with Manasseh, who's eventually going to kill him. The father, the son, and the grandfather. Or grandson, or whatever. Okay. Chapter 16, verse 1 of 2 Kings. In the 70th year of Pekah, son of Remaliah in Israel, Ahaz, son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. Ahaz was 20 years old and he became king. And he reigned in Jerusalem 16 years. Unlike David, his father, he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord, his God. He walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. He even sacrificed his sons in the fire, or his son in the fire. Second Chronicles is going to say sons, plural. Following the detestable ways of the nations of the Lord had driven out before the Israelites. He offered sacrifice and burnt incense on the high places, on the hilltops, and under every spreading tree. They're worshiping this God. And then Rezin, king of Aram, and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, marched up to fight against Jerusalem and besieged Ahaz, but they could not overpower him. That's where we went off into Isaiah chapter 7 and 8. That's the context. At that time, Rezin, king of Aram, recovered Elath and for Aram by driving out the men of Judah. Edomites then moved into the Elath, and they live there to this day. Ahaz sent messengers to say to Tiglath-Pileser. Ahaz sends up to Tiglath-Pileser saying, I am your servant, meaning I want to make a covenant with you, and vassal. Come up and save me out of the hand of the king of Aram and the king of Israel. Save me from Rezin and Pekah. And that's Isaiah telling him, don't do this. You don't need to. By the time this baby's old enough to say yes or no, they're going to be gone. Just hide for a while. Just sit down and go watch a video. They're going to be gone. There's nothing you can do. Just wait. Then Ahaz took the silver and gold found in the temple of the Lord and in the treasuries of the royal palace and sent them as a gift to the king of Assyria, unleashing the flood that Isaiah says that's not going to stop once he gets to the border of Israel. It's going to come right across into Judah. The king of Assyria complied by attacking Damascus and capturing it. He deported its inhabitants to Kir and put Rezin to death. There's Isaiah's prophecy being fulfilled. He's dead. And he's going to do that anyhow. He didn't need the gold. He's going to do that. He wants the trade routes. He's going to kill him anyhow. You don't need to pay him. Then King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet with Tiglath-Pileser. So now King Ahaz goes up to meet Tiglath-Pileser. He saw an altar in Damascus and sent to Uriah the priest a sketch of the altar, the drawing plans. This is Uriah the priest who signed the scroll that has swift to the plunder, quick to the spoil of Isaiah's little boy on. So now the priest, he gets the building plans with detailed plans for its construction. So Uriah the priest built an altar in accordance with all the plans that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus and finished it before King Ahaz returned. He emails the plans. By the time he travels back, oh, yes, exactly. That's exactly what I saw in Assyria. When the king came back from Damascus and saw the altar, he approached it. That means he approaches it to worship on it and presented offerings on it. He offered up his burnt offering and grain offerings. He's following the law of Moses, offering God's offerings on the Assyrian altar that's now in front of the temple. Poured out his drink offerings and sprinkled the blood of his fellowship offerings on the altar. So this is Yahweh. You understand? He's following. Every one of those is a Mosaic Levitical sacrifice. You see, he can say, I'm a man of the word. I'm a word man. I'm following the law of Moses. I'm offering the sacrifices prescribed by Moses. Yeah, but you're not. You're on a pagan altar worshiping what God are you? I'm worshiping the way the Lord told me to. And when it doesn't work, he's going to get mad and blame God. Because I was following God. No, you're not. You're so far off base. But he's close enough to justify it to the ignorance mind. King Ahaz then gave these orders to Uriah the priest. On the large new altar, offer morning and burnt offerings and the evening grain offerings, the king's burnt offerings and the grain offerings and the burnt offerings of all the people of the land and their grain offerings and their drink offerings. Sprinkle on the altar all the blood of the burnt offerings and sacrifices, but I will use the bronze altar for seeking guidance. And Uriah the priest did just as the king Ahaz ordered. They moved the Lord's altar over there, and they put all of the Lord's sacrifice offerings on this altar. Even the people's offerings went on this altar. But when I need to inquire of the Lord, and I need some kind of uttering type of, you know, insight, vision, I'll go over there. And that's why I said, just, would you consult the text? You're not supposed to be over there muttering to God on his temp or in his altar. You're completely out of bounds. King Ahaz took away the side panels and removed the basin from the movable stands. He removed the sea of the bronze bulls that support it. That's the bronze basin. He took away the Sabbath canopy that had been built at the temple and removed the royal entryway outside the temple, Lord, in deference to the king of Assyria. As for the other events of his reign, Ahaz and all he did, are they not written in the book of the Annals of the Kings? I want to go now, and I've got 30 seconds or something. Go to 2 Chronicles 28. Oh, my goodness. I appreciate you being here. 2 Chronicles 28. It's just interesting to see this now again. You've got the same account, chapter 28. Ahaz was 20 years old. You can see in verse 3, he sacrificed his sons, plural, in the fire. Talks about Pekah there. Verse 9. But a prophet of the Lord named Obed was there, and he went out to meet with the army when they returned to Samaria. He said to them, because the Lord, the God of your father, was angry with Judah, so now he's got a prophet speaking to him there. We continue on. I'm in verse 22. In his time of trouble, King Ahaz became even more unfaithful to the Lord. He offered sacrifice to the gods of Damascus that we read in 2 Kings, who had defeated him. For he thought, since the gods of the kings of Aram have helped them, I will sacrifice to them so they will help me. Verse 24, Ahaz gathered together the furnishings of the temple of his God and took them away. He shut the doors of the Lord's temple. Very important. He shut the doors of the Lord's temple and set up altars at every street corner in Jerusalem. In every town of Judah, he built high places to burn sacrifice to the other gods. As the other events are they not written, he rested with his fathers and died. And now Hezekiah, chapter 29, Hezekiah is going to become king now in Judah. Now, what we need to do next week, and I'm sorry, we need to go now read 2 Kings 17 next week. Because 2 Kings 17 is when Tiglath-Pileser sets up a king here named Hoshea, the last king of Israel. And Hoshea is going to have a decade or so that he's going to rule under Tiglath-Pileser. He's going to eventually fall and rebel, and all of this is going to be taken captive. If you look on the chart that I gave you, after Tiglath-Pileser, you're going to have Shalmaneser, followed by Sargon. And Israel is going to fall next week, and the northern tribe is going to fall completely in chapter 17, the last year of Shalmaneser and the first year of Sargon. And so it's going to be right around 722, 721 is when this falls, and this is overrun. This becomes the land of the Gentiles at this time. And they're going to move people in. This is where the Samaritans are going to start to come from. There's going to be a mixture of people. We'll talk about that as we develop this whole thing. Israel has moved out. The lost 10 tribes, they call them. Some of them still remain. In 700, Sennacherib is going to come down and surround Jerusalem. But what has happened is a lot of these people in the Israelites, the different tribes, are going to flee down to Jerusalem. And that's why Hezekiah is going to have to expand the city, because the lost 10 tribes, I've got to quit. You've got to decide, are they lost? Because they really didn't get lost. Many of them fled down here to join Judah. So when the Babylonians took them captive, they took captive all 12 tribes, because they all didn't capture everybody and disperse. We lost them. Some people were lost. There may be lost tribes out there. But there's representations of all the tribes still in Judah when the Babylonians show up, because they fled down here, and Hezekiah had to build a wall. You can see it in the framework book to accommodate them, and that's one of the reasons he built the tunnel. So anyway, this land now becomes a land of Gentiles. That didn't go as clean as I wanted it to, but it never really does. Okay, I'm going to pray, and I do appreciate you being here. Thank you for taking time. We'll have Israel fall, and we'll get into the framework text next week with Jeremiah, Josiah, and Hezekiah's day. Father, again, thank you again for the chance to read your text. We thank you for revealing yourself through your Word of God. And I do ask that we would take these things to heart, that we would examine our own lives, that we would examine the own situations we find ourselves in and make application, that we'd seek your guidance and walk in your truth. We thank you for being merciful to us, and ask that we may see revival in our land, in our time. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you very much.